bring, and I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have us on the line, Anita Dietman, and of course she is has a new book out, and she wrote it along with Jan Markell, entitled Trapped in Hitler's Hell. A young Jewish girl discovers the Messiah's faithfulness in the midst of the Holocaust, and of course Anita was only 6 years old in 1933 when Hitler was first coming to power. Anita, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I feel very honored. I already had a nice talk with your wife, and she sounds so lovely.
Well, she really is.
That's good.
She has to be to put up with me under any circumstances.
Oh,
why don't you sort of tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and your background? Because, so rather than my telling them about your background and your family, why don't you go ahead and start out?
Should I just start from the beginning?
You start at the very beginning. That's what the story's about.
All right. I was born in Breslau, Germany, in East Germany, located very close to the Polish border, a city of about 658,000 population. My mother came from a rather somewhat Orthodox Jewish background. However, when she was 19, she renounced her Jewish faith and joined the ranks of the intellectuals of her time. And then she started to dabble a little bit in astrology and Eastern religion. My father, the Gentile, was a confirmed atheist. Alone I can, he would proclaim. Religion was for the weak. So as a result, my older sister and I had absolutely no Christian nurture whatsoever. But we didn't know what we were missing because we were so comfortably wealthy. We lived in a rather nice suburb of the big city, and we had everything our hearts desired except Christ in our life. I was born with an agile body. I loved dancing, and my mother enrolled me in a ballet school when I was only 4 years old, and my teacher was a retired ballerina who in her younger years had been very famous. When she saw my talent and my love for dancing, she said, "Girl, with your talent and my training, I'm going to make you into a famous ballerina. It's a wonderful life. People will literally worship you." Well, it was marvelous for me. I mean, I just gave it my all. I lived ballet. But somehow I came to realize, not too long after Hitler started, that God had a different idea for my life. He didn't want me to live to be worshipped. He wanted me to live to worship him. Life was very easy the first 5.5 years, but when Hitler came to power, it changed. Soon after Adolf Hitler and the Nazis took over, my father left us. He had a prestigious job, and it was too difficult for him to be married to a Jew. He couldn't accept that. And in addition, he had once belonged to the Social Democratic Party, which was Hitler's arch enemy before he took power. And so he had two strikes against himself. And when he left us, that wonderful life of earthly splendor came to a sudden stop, and literally overnight, my mother, my older sister, and I were transferred into the most devastating poverty you can imagine.
And, of course, the thing is that in Germany, if a Gentile was married to a Jew, they would lose their prestige. And so, for his own defense, he left your family, he abandoned them, because he was more concerned about his safety and his prosperity, really.
Right. Yeah, it was very difficult for us. We lived on welfare, and of course that was very skimpy. It's worse than it is now.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment
here.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest today is Anita Dietman, and we're talking about her book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell. And, of course, she wrote it with another lady who's done a lot of writing, but it's a wonderful story about a young Jewish girl living in Hitler's Germany. And, you know, she's raised in a very comfortable, very prosperous family. Her father was a Gentile. Her mother was a Jew, a sort of atheistic, even into the occult and the New Age. And then suddenly, when Hitler came to power, and she was 6 years old in 1933, three when Hitler came to power. Why, of course, her father left her mother because he would be persecuted in living and being married to a Jew, abandoned the family, and the mother and two children were plunged into abject poverty. And so pick up the story there, 1933, somewhere there, and of course you are suddenly trapped in this situation, an impossible situation.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I remember I was sort of at the end of, toward the end of first grade, going on to age seven, that I was permitted, or rather asked by my ballet teacher, to participate in a real gala performance with many dance numbers. And when my number had been completed and I had danced, I was in my seventh heaven because the applause of the big, huge audience was just ear-splitting. It was just overwhelming, and I knew this was the beginning of this wonderful life that my teacher had predicted for me, only to find out the next day when my mother got a newspaper that it stated the article stated, you know, everything about every number, and then when they came to mine, they said, oh, the dance was superbly performed by young Anita Dittmann, but the German people are no longer willing to be entertained by a Jew. And in addition, all the funds had run out. We were too poor, and that was the end of my hopes and dreams. And, of course, I wept bitterly, but, you know, I found out very soon after that that God has a very unique and beautiful way to pick up all the shattered fragments of our hopes and dreams and mold them into a plan of His own. A plan, I found out, vastly different from ours, but much more conducive to our spiritual growth.
And, of course, you really, there was just never quite enough food, and then there was difficulty getting to school because, of course, it cost money to go to schools. And so pick up the story.
Okay. When I was about, I just want to talk about my conversion.
All right, fine.
That's a beautiful story.
You hold that right just for a moment, because I want to bring all of our stations back on, and I want our listeners to hear the story of your conversion.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Anita was training to be a ballerina, and she had an opportunity to actually dance before a great audience, and they just were so taken over with her talent, except that the newspapers the next day came out and talked about how the German people were not going to, no longer going to be entertained by Jews, and of course, her mother didn't have the money to keep her in the ballerina school, and so, you know, this little girl, she's 7 years old, and suddenly he's no longer able to continue learning to dance, which was her passion. She wanted to be a famous ballerina. So then pick up the story there.
Yes, okay. Well, soon after that happened, my friends that lived above in our little apartment building took me to a church, and on a Sunday morning, and it was there that Christ came into my life. It was very beautiful, nothing dramatic, but very beautiful, and I suddenly felt a wonderful security that I had never felt inside of me, that I'd never felt before, and I was so overjoyed, and I raced home with my friends after the service and wanted to share it with my mother and my older sister, but they weren't ready for it. They just simply brushed it aside as a childish fantasy, and I started to pray for them. But it took a while until my mother came to realize what it was all about. Time marched on very quickly, and pretty soon I was ready to go into high school. High school in Germany at that time started in fifth grade, and I was very blessed to attend a parochial school where I was taught by lovely teachers who no longer persecuted me like they did in the state schools, where teachers were very unfair and sometimes very cruel. And the children in the school also were kind. Many of them hadn't joined the Hitler Youth Group yet. And it was very beautiful, and it was during that time that we were introduced to a pastor of an inner-city church, a pastor who also was facing some persecution because he belonged to a confessional movement like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and therefore was, you know, his life was at stake because Hitler not only persecuted the Jews, he persecuted the the true Christian ministers too. But this pastor had a love for the Jewish people. And he reached out to us. He heard about us and reached out to us. And after a few months of attending the church and going to Bible study, my mother accepted Christ in her life. And it was not just about this man's teaching and preaching, but it was the love that he had for the Jewish people and the love of Christ that showed in every bit of his life. And that was so convincing to her, and it was just wonderful. And he also helped me to have a much deeper faith, not to use Christ only as my best friend, but as my Lord and Savior. My sister never really accepted Christ in her life. She just pretended on the surface.
Well, of course, and of course, things begin to get worse and worse for
yes.
you and your family.
Yes.
I mean, after all, the Nazis, of course, beginning to move against the Jewish people. And of course, you are half Jewish. Your mother is fully Jewish, but she is not, you know, she has accepted the Christian faith. So that gives you at least a little advantage over so many of your other relatives who were Jewish, who you were just taken off to the concentration camps and
well,
never heard
my mother, my mother was eventually picked up too, but. One thing was, we were soon after my mother accepted Christ in her life in the end of 1938, almost end of December of 1938. We were told that we had to move out of the district and move into the inner city Jewish ghetto, where the buildings were about 200 years old. They were infested with bedbugs and rats and mice and everything, and we're four families shared one apartment, each family residing in one room, sharing one bathroom, one kitchen. But we soon adapted to each other's needs. But what was horrible, this was now the beginning of 1939.
And, of course, the war starts in 1939, and things really get bad for the Jews.
Yes, but now we had just passed through November 38, where they burned all the synagogues except one, and where the Jewish businesses were, the windows were smashed and people were taken to concentration camps. So it was pretty scary. And we, even though we adapted to each other's needs and all these families living in one apartment, but what was horrible was that constant fear that any moment there could be that knock at the front door and two SS men would march in and pick out either one family or one member out of a family. Well, at that time, an organization that through my pastor was working for us to go to England. And in 1939, in the summer of, it was middle of July, my sister's visa arrived, and we got her ready, and we were promised that my mother's and my visa would arrive any time, and we got my sister ready to go to England. And on August 31st, she literally left with the last train that crossed the border of Germany into Holland. The next day, all the borders were closed. Our visas got lost in the mail because no foreign mail was allowed in the country. No traffic was allowed in the country. And my mother and I were literally trapped in Hitler's hell, and that's what the name of the book. But we still had each other, my mother and I, and we were still what we called relatively free. Unfortunately, my wonderful time in the parochial school had ended. I had to go back to the state schools, where I was facing renewed persecution by my peers as well as my teachers, although some kids were nice and some teachers were nice too, but most of them weren't. But at least I still got an education. But you know, that didn't last long either.
And of course, your mother was having to work, wasn't she?
She was drafted into very heavy factory labor, and I was alone at home a great deal of the time. And one fine day when I was 15, the principal of my school walked into my classroom, and he said, "Dittmann, pack up all your things." And then he handed me a notification of the Gestapo that due to my Jewish heritage, I was permanently suspended from school. And he added to it, and he said, "It's high time that the German government is cleansing our school system of riffraff such as yourself." And about 2 months later, I too was drafted into very heavy factory labor, where I worked 10 hours a day together with my mother, and 6 days a week. But we still had Sunday morning to go to church. And our pastor would impress upon us, he said, "Hilde, even if a death camp is the ultimate for you, death is but the door to eternal life," and that gave us a lot of hope. One fine morning, it was about the 7th of January, there was a knock at the door again, and Mother and I were just getting ready to go to the factory. And this time, unfortunately, the two SS men grabbed my mother. It was her turn now. Her sisters had already been all taken. They had lived with us for a while, and they were all taken to concentration camps. And this time it was for my mother. They put red labels on everything in all the furniture, everything in our room where we resided, except my bed, my clothes, and my very personal belongings. And I was told that this is now the property of the state, and I may keep my bed, my clothes, and my very personal belongings. And the next day, all these items would be taken to the headquarters warehouse of the Gestapo, and if I wanted anything back, I would have to purchase it back. And of course, I didn't earn that much money in the factory, but my mother had just enough time before they took her away to give me my father's home phone number. He lived in a different city. He had remarried. And she said maybe he could help you. And I know I called him, and he did help me with money so that I didn't lose all of the furniture.
And so you actually had to rest and back all of your own furniture.
Yeah.
But it was a constant fear of the Gestapo, of that knock coming at the door, and they'd actually taken all the other families there in your apartment, hadn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah. It was terrible. I mean, I found out after about two or three weeks where they had taken my mother. She was taken to Camp Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia, and an odd thing happened, and this is just full of miracles. She was allowed, or they were allowed, to receive food packages occasionally, and I realized that on my factory salary I couldn't afford to buy food on the black market, so I just knew that this is time now for me to reciprocate for all that my mother had done for me for my 16 and a half years. So I prayed to God, and I said, I will be glad to give her practically all my rations and send things to her, but God, I need you to keep me strong. And he did. For 7 months, I literally ate no more but a piece of bread in the morning and drank a cup of imitation coffee. And then I would work hard all day, come home, and maybe had a watery soup or maybe a bowl full of lettuce if I was lucky. Lived that way for 7 months. And you know, I never lost an ounce of weight. I remained totally untouched by all the epidemics. I showed no signs of malnutrition. I never had cold or flu. And I had enough energy to give away. My stomach growled, oh yes, but it was so wonderful to get a little card from her every now and then where she would list every item that she had received. And because it was a known factor that sometimes the Nazi guards would help themselves to some of the contents. And in July, I had been alone now for a little over 6 months, I decided not to send her the dark German rye bread that I usually send to her, which is very solid, very different from your bread over here. And I picked up a box of Zwieback, which is toast, and couldn't figure out why I was doing it, only to find out 10 days later when I got a card from my mother that she had been stricken with dysentery and could not tolerate the dark bread. And God, she had pleaded with God to convey to me to send her Zwieback. I said, that's a hotline to heaven, isn't it?
Well, God works in strange and wonderful ways, and of course, you were really at this point in your life, you had to be totally dependent upon God because you had nobody else to turn to.
Exactly. Yes.
And I think it's such an important message that I hope our listeners will heed what you have to say and the story that you tell. And this is really a wonderful, touching book. It's called Trapped in Hitler's Hell. A young Jewish girl discovers the Messiah's faithfulness in the midst of the Holocaust. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Anita Dietman. Her book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, a fascinating and very, very touching story. And so your mother's in the concentration camp. You're at home. We're really having very little to eat. Did you have to have some sort of a card? Were there rations, or was it simply monetary?
No, it was rations. Our food was, everything was rations. There was nothing that you could get without rations. Yeah. But it was really nice. There are some of the merchants where I used to buy things. they knew about my mother, and sometimes they'd slip an extra little piece of cheese in, or maybe an extra egg or something, and I could always use the eggs to make a cake for, you know, some bread or something for my mother and send it to her. And they were very sympathetic. They didn't dare to let it be known, but they were very kind, and it was really heartwarming to see that there are lots of people that still had a heart for the Jewish people.
And so there were good Germans and there were bad Germans. There were the Nazis, of course, and even some of the Nazis, I'm sure, were trapped in this whole system.
Oh, yeah. But do you want me to go on?
Yes, please do.
Okay. And anyway, this was now August. My mother had recovered from the dysentery, and she was so grateful that I sent her the Zweibach. Well, it was August 9th, and I came home from work. I had been alone now for just a couple of days, over 7 months. And I had a notification from the Gestapo in my mailbox informing me that the next day I would be shipped off to an unknown destination, that I had to stand in line in the morning with about 300 others like myself. And I thought, Lord, how am I going to let my mother know? Please inspire me. And I pleaded with him to give me the right thoughts. And I went to a store that was still open, I purchased a loaf of the dark German rye bread, and that had a label on one end, and I trimmed the label off, and stuck a knife in there and pushed a note in there deep, deep into the bread, and then I sealed the bread again with that red label, and you couldn't tell that I'd ever touched it. And in that note, I let my mother know that I have to leave for a while, and I tried to be real gentle, though she wouldn't be too frightened, but I figured she would know what I was meaning. And then I asked a friend of mine in the ghetto who did not have to go, would she please ship that bread to my mother? And I prayed that the Lord would protect that loaf from falling into the hands of a Nazi guard, because if he would have found the note, he would have killed my mother. And God protected it, and I found that out many, many months later, that for the first time the bread had arrived totally covered with a thick, thick, fluffy cover of mold. And I know that no Nazi guard would have wanted to eat that, but my mother was so starved that she scraped off all the mold and started slicing the bread, and this is how she found the note. And I said, it just brings tears to my ears, to my eyes and my throat, to realize how wonderful God is to protect that loaf of bread, to wrap it in mold. I mean, it's just so fantastic. Well, the campsite for me was the women that lived in a filthy old cow barn. It was the camp was located many, many miles north of my hometown. The men lived in a filthy old cow barn, cow stable, not too far from us. The cow barn had never been cleaned out. It was only covered with a thick layer of fresh straw. We were each given about two
hold that off right there, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan, Anita tells, of course, that she eventually is notified by the Gestapo. She is going to go to a concentration camp. She gets a message to her mother. You're going to have to read the book to find out how it was that she was able to get the message into her mother. But here again was an example of God's providence. And so now, Anita, how old were you about this time?
17.
You were 17. She's been taken to a work camp, a concentration camp. And what sort of work did they have you doing?
Okay, we were housed about 150 women in this old cow barn, and it had one water faucet on the outside, cold water, and the toilet facility was a ditch. And we were issued little enamel pans to share with 9 other women for our daily bath. We were awakened at about 4 o'clock in the morning. We were counted and recounted, and then, of course, it was August, it was hot. And then we were given a piece of bread and a cup of this imitation coffee, and then they loaded us up with heavy digging equipment, spades, picks, and shovels, and then they marched us off. And finally we came to our workplace, and we were told that we were now going to be digging ditches. And the ditches were about, 7 feet deep, perhaps, and probably 10, 15 feet wide, and I don't know how many kilometers long. We worked about 8 to 10 hours in the burning sun. We had a sip of water now and then. Once in a while, they'd bring us some watery soup, but not very often. We weren't really allowed to speak to each other, so we were constantly digging. It was very, very hard labor.
And, of course, you were really, they were having to dig these ditches as tank traps for the advancing Russians, was that?
Yeah, it? Yeah, right. And yet Hitler was always proclaiming, we are winning, but they were afraid, you know, that the Russians might come in. Well, we worked that way every day, and then in the evening we had some free time after we stood in line for a solid hour or longer for our food ration, which was a watery soup, of course, and then they would give us a piece of bread for the next morning, and usually the rats would eat that up. But when winter came, it was more difficult because we were finally done digging ditches and we were moved to a different location. We were not sleeping in the barn anymore, but it was just this primitive, and we were still sleeping. We were sleeping on straw bags, and we had to go to an outhouse, which was quite a ways from the camp, from the building. And we had to fight the winter elements. It was, again, located in a village. It was very difficult because it was very cold. We were insufficiently dressed. We worked outside. We worked in the forest. We had to cut huge pine trees, and then we had to cut all the branches off and then take wires and wrap the branches around the tree trunk. And then they were stacked in big piles, and then somebody would come and pick them up, some horse and horse cart, and then they would take them to the site where we had dug ditches. And they used those contraptions that we made to pad the walls of the ditches so that they would be more firm. And we were also finding out that when our work was completed, that we would be shipped to Auschwitz to be cremated. So no matter how many lice crawled on our heads, no matter how cold we were, no matter how hungry we were and how dirty we were, we just praised the Lord we were not yet in Auschwitz.
The people over there were well aware, the Jews were well aware of what was going on in Auschwitz at the time?
Oh, yes, yes. We knew very well because, see, Auschwitz and Dachau and Buchenwald started in 1938 when they burned all the synagogues. So we had, some people did come back, some didn't come back. But we, you know, the news got out very quickly what was going on. So we knew what we were headed for. Well, it was January 23rd, 1945, when we were all called outside. We had to stand in formation.
Now, January 23rd, 1945, you say?
January 23rd, 1945.
Okay, so the war is beginning to wind down, but of course, you don't know whether you're going to survive.
No,
or not.
Not really. Not yet. Oh, no. But we were standing in formation, and then some people escaped that night, and they wanted me to come with them. They had a way of getting to back to my hometown. But our administration saw them and couldn't catch them, and so they called the Gestapo in my hometown, and all these people were captured and killed. And I just praise God for the person that kept me from going, because otherwise I wouldn't be here tonight to tell you, because all these people that escaped were killed. We marched and marched and marched that night. We thought they were going to march us to death. And they finally found a new campsite for us where we did the most ridiculous but very, very hard labor. And my shoes had worn out, and I was issued a pair of shoes with wooden soles and high tops where the material was very rough. And since we could no longer wash our clothes...
Hold that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Anita Dietman. And go ahead, Anita. Tell that you were saying that you really couldn't wash at that time. You had
no, we could wash our bodies, nor could we wash. We lived under very primitive circumstances, but, you know, we kept on working every day. And a blister had rubbed on my right heel, and my stocking, of course, had rubbed to the point where there was a hole, and the blister evidently popped at one point, and dirt got in, because we were dirty and our clothes was dirty. and an infection started, and I could see my foot turning color. It started swelling slightly. The lymph glands in my groin started hurting and swelling, and I felt feverish, but I could not let go, because you see, anybody that wasn't fit to work was either shot on the spot or tortured to death. And even though I was aware that death camp was my ultimate, I still had this hope that with God's help, if he wanted me to live, I would live. So I tried not to limp, and I luckily have a very high pain threshold, and so sometimes I would lean on a friend, and work kept on. And so one night, it was now February of 1945, to be exact, it was the 10th of February of 1945, we were marching home from work, and it was very dark, and yet this sky was lit up a bright red, and we could hear roaring in the distance. We could even feel vibrations, and we saw the villagers fleeing from this little city, country city of Grünberg. They were all fleeing with their livestock, with their belongings piled high on wagons that were pulled by horses. And one person in our camp as we were going home, we stepped out, and when somebody asked what is going on, and they said the Russians are immensely close. And that night, our authorities locked up our women's camp so tight, nobody could escape. We didn't know what was going to happen to us. And all night long, we didn't sleep, and we looked through tiny little dirty windows. You know, we'd brush the dirt aside and see what was going on. And we saw our guards marching around our camp with bayonets and rifles over their shoulder, and we didn't know what was going to happen to us. And there were five girls, five of us, that we were very, very close to each other all through camp, and we prayed all night long that if it was God's will, would he deliver us out of the hands of our persecutors. We knew that it would take a mighty miracle. Well, morning came. All the women were ordered to climb on horse-drawn wagons that were chauffeured by Polish prisoners of war that worked as slaves on German farms. The men were held back. We didn't know what was going to happen to them. And two guards followed us, and we were whisked off. And it was very cold, very dark. We didn't know where we were going to go.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Anita has a very, very bad infection in her foot because of a blister, and then of course they're getting into January, February of 1945, and the Russians are coming. All the women in the camp are piled into these carts. They're driven, and they don't know where they're going. They don't know what's going to happen. So pick up the story there.
Okay, well, as we were going on, our guards kept falling because it was icy and snowy on the road, but they eventually caught up with us. And finally, we could see in the early morning the outline of a camp, a complex of barracks, and the smokestack rising into the heavens in the middle, and the whole camp was surrounded by barbed wire fences and electrically loaded, and we knew what that meant. And finally, we had arrived there, and the gates swung open, and I'm not going to go into detail. People can read that in the book. But the Lord performed a miracle of miracle. Every year I read this, every year I celebrate. The Lord delivered us out of the hands of our persecutors. He used angels in human form to help us along the way. And when we were finally far, far away and we were finding refuge in the home of the in-laws of one of my campmates, this horrible infection that had raged through my body for so long just took over, and I had to be hospitalized. And of course, most hospitals were run by Nazis. But there was one Nazi doctor, a woman who poses a Nazi, but she wasn't, and you'll find out why I'm saying this. Anyway, I fell into the hands of a Nazi nurse who admitted me. Of course, I looked like my father's side of the family. I had long blonde hair, and nobody would have ever guessed I had an ounce of Jewish blood in my veins. I was just laying there, and she was trying to take off my stocking. My leg was so swollen and blue, and when she rambled on about this wonderful Führer, leader, you know, Hitler and what he's done for the Third Reich, and her Nazi pin would usually stare at me, at my face, and I just felt like I would like to throw up in her face when she was talking about this wonderful leader. And at one point she left to get a pair of scissors to cut off my stocking because my leg was so swollen, and my friends beckoned me not to say anything, and I said, of course not. Well, at first it was nice. I was lying between white sheets. I didn't even know what it was like to sleep in a bed anymore. However, there was a shortage on doctors, a shortage on nurses, and also a shortage on medical supplies. And there were no antibiotics available except sulfon. I was allergic to it. So they didn't know what they were going to do. This young woman doctor came to look at it, and she said, well, all we can do is just wrap the wound into some disinfectant solution and see if that would help, but it didn't. So after about a week or so, my fever was rising very high. The doctor came again, and she ordered a surgery. They drilled two holes on the outside of my foot on kind near the instep and put tubes in there because it's all they could do, and they had some dark ointment that they put on. And, of course, under the anesthesia, which was ether, which was given to me by that Nazi nurse that admitted me, I must have spoken, because when I woke up, it's still on the operating table because, you know, there was even a shortage on anesthesia. I heard this nurse saying to the doctor, my, that little girl ever talk a lot. And I knew in an instant what I must have said. I must have revealed who I was and where I came from. And she turned against me. And this nurse did everything she could to kill me, because there was a medal for every Nazi that would kill a Jew. And she was working for that medal. She would permit unsanitary conditions, and she would keep the doctor away from me, which was easy because there was a shortage on doctors. And, of course, dirt got into the wounds, and my condition got worse. And then at one point, the doctor came and saw this, and she says, oh, my God. She just threw up her hand. She said, we're going to have to cut more holes into your foot. So they cut holes in the inside of my foot, still by the instep, then under the ankle bone. And she said, we'll try some more. Well, of course, this nurse, again, did really her dirty work, as they say. And again, my fever rose, and pretty soon there was a lump in the inside of my upper thigh, and I knew that was pus. And again, my fever started rising, and she had kept the doctor away for 2 weeks, and my condition got so bad. Finally, the doctor came, and you see, the nurse had told the doctor that I was doing fine, and when she saw this, she was horrified. She said, well, we're just going to have to cut you open again. And again, this nurse was giving me the anesthesia. So they cut a hole, a deep hole, into my upper thigh, and I'm not going to, it was very large opening, and they stuck tubes in there. And now what I'm going to tell you is going to be pretty repulsive, but when she saw that, she gave me an enema and left me on the bedpan for 2 hours, and all the feces and all the urine ran into the open wound and created more of an infection. And pretty soon I had another lump in there, and the fever was rising again. And she was keeping the doctor away. But at that point, God was really watching over me. At that point, my friend, who would always come to visit me, came. She was one of the campmates that had escaped. And she saw this, and she quickly went over to the doctor's apartment and pleaded with her to come and see me the next day. And this doctor said, why? The nurses told me that your friend is getting well. No, she said, that's all a lie. And then the doctor came the next day, and she suspended that nurse from my case. She was very, very daring to do that. And the nurse was put into another part of the hospital. And praise the Lord, because she could have given me a few more drops of ether and I would have been killed, but another nurse gave me the anesthesia, and then they enlarged that one cut and then made another cut near the knee and then dug a passage from one to the other underneath, but they gave me very little hope that they could save my leg because they said they would be operating so close to a main artery that the leg would have come off if they slipped up. So I prayed that night. I said, Lord, please, I want to see my mother again. If she is alive, please help me. If you want me to live, please help me to keep my leg. And I was just overwhelmed. You know, the pain was horrible because there was no pain pills or anything afterwards. But I was so thankful for the pain. I wept in gratitude that I had the pain because I knew I had the leg. I looked several times under the cover and felt to make sure that I wasn't dreaming. And I was just so grateful to God. And from then on, the infection drained, and it was uphill. I mean, it was, you know, I started to recover somewhat, but I remember one time my girlfriend came and she looked at my wounds. I showed them to her and she was so almost repulsed by them, and she said, "How can God do this to you?" And I said, "Don't say this." I said, "God knows what he's doing." And I said, "Remember Romans 8:28, and all things work together for good to those that love God," and so forth. And she said, "But you have been so faithful to him." I said, "God loves me. I know he's permitting this for a purpose." And I said, "I can guarantee you that someday these wounds are going to be my protection." Well, after 6 weeks of being flat on my back, I was allowed to walk again. And there was still, the wounds were still draining. They had taken the tubes out, but there was still a lot of drainage, and they were wide open. And my girlfriend came and steadied me and helped me taught me to walk again, because I had lost the muscles in both legs. I had lost my equilibrium. And I worked feverishly for 4 days, and on the fourth day, the sirens howled. The Russians came to town, and everybody was ordered into the air raid shelter. Men, women, children, all together. And when the Russians occupied the town, they were starting to rape the women, the patients, nurses, doctors, women doctors. And at one point, I was pulled off my cot that I had shared with three other women, and they threw Russians threw me on a mattress on the floor. They ripped off all my clothes, and they were both going to rape me. They reminded me of the SS because they had on leather coats and heavy boots, and they were looking at me with greedy eyes, and this was just like a scene out of hell, and everybody looking on, children, women patients, male patients. It was horrible, and I laid there with my birthday suit, and then they saw this heavy bandage on my leg. They thought maybe I was faking, so they asked a student nurse to come over and unwrap the bandage. And praise the Lord, when the last bit of the bandage came off, the pus squirted out like a geyser, and I grossed these men out so badly that they took off and ran. And ever after, when I was facing rape, these wounds were always my protection. Praise God. This is what I had predicted to my friend.
And then, of course, the German nurse was there in the shelter with you.
Yes.
That would have been so cruel to you.
Yes. At one point, in a pause in fighting, I dragged my heavy sore leg to the outer hall of the air raid shelter, and there in the dark, where I was carrying a candle, I saw this nurse sitting on the floor on the mattress weeping profusely, and I know God wanted me to comfort her, but you know, I had to ask the Lord to cleanse me of all of my bitterness and my resentment against her, and I said, "Lord, put your Holy Spirit of love into my heart and forgive me that I have this attitude toward her. Take it away so that I am able to comfort her." And he did this, and because I realized, after all, Christ died for her too. And so I dragged my leg over there and knelt down beside her, and she wept in my arms bitterly and wept and told me that she had been raped many times. Well, I shared this horror with her, and I wept with her, and all of a sudden she pushed herself away from me, and she said, "How can you possibly love me and comfort me when I tried to kill you? Don't you realize I tried to kill you?" I said, "Yes, I did. But I prayed to God that he would help me not to be bitter towards you, and I forgive you." And I said, "I can only do it through Christ's help." And I said, "After all, he died for you too, not just for me." Well, unfortunately, the Germans recaptured the town, and for just a short while, and part of the hospital was evacuated, and I was among them. And we were evacuated into Sudetenland, which is a mountainous chain between Czechoslovakia and Germany. And, well, my wounds were still draining and open, but they figured that I had recovered enough. And I was told one morning, it was about probably the middle of April, close to Hitler's birthday, which is on the 20th of April, and I was told one morning, "Go home, Anita, we need your bed." And I didn't know where home was. And I stood there the next morning with my leg still being bandaged. And I didn't have any crutches. I didn't have a cane. And I said, Lord, you are going to have to be my crutch, and I'm going to be leaning on you. And, of course, it was God sent me on a very long and a very treacherous journey. He doesn't always send us on a smooth road. And I read something beautiful in my daily devotional the other day where it said that safety is not the absence of danger, but the presence of God. And I can testify to that. He really walked with me every step of the way. And in the book, everything is very much abbreviated and condensed. But finally, I came to pretty much almost the end of my journey, which lasted many, many weeks. And I encountered some horrible situations. And my life was in danger constantly. But finally, the war was over. And I secured a passport, because I knew that the only way that I could find my mother would be to go back to Theresienstadt, because I had heard that the Russians had liberated that. I mean, the Russians weren't all bad. There were some good ones, too, and many of them liberated our concentration camps. And I was issued a passport in three languages, English, Czech, and Russian. And when I set out, I didn't know how I was going to get there. I was warned by everybody not to go alone. I was young. I was blonde. I looked German. I spoke German. I remembered very little school English. But I just, and all I had left was what I had on my body, a pajama top and a pair of ski pants and so forth, and a small bag where I carried a little winter jacket and a sweater, and everything was in the pockets of my ski pants. My passport, all my belongings. And I set out that day and I prayed. I said, Lord, you're my crutch, you're my guide, and you're my protection. And I was told that maybe I should pretend to be a deaf mute. And I said, for me to be a deaf mute, it'd take another miracle. But God protected me. And when I came toward the end of my journey, a difficult journey, I was in a train and it was dark outside, and I was looking out the window thinking that I was safe because, you know, I couldn't speak the language of the Czech people, and they would kill anybody that was German because the Germans had been so horrible to them. Well, when I was on that journey, all of a sudden I felt a hand on my shoulder and a man speaking from behind me, or rather sitting next to me, in a language I presume to be Czech. And he looked at me. There was a dim light there. He looked at me, and he looked at me at first, and he said, Niemitz, which means German but not a complimentary term. And I kind of shook my head. I said, no, and I used English. I said, no, I'm not. But I had just enough time to take the passport out of my pants and show it to him, and in the dim light he read it in his own language that I was a victim of Nazism, that I was also Jewish, and that I was going to Theresienstadt to find my mother. And his eyes filled in a broken German. He said to me, I am a Jew too. I have been incarcerated for many years. I've lost my entire family. He said, I will be your friend. I will help you. I will walk with you. I will try to find a ride to your mother's camp. And he did that. He had lived in Prague. He was coming back from a camp, and he was hoping maybe that to find some friend that knew him. And he walked with me to Prague. He went with me to on another train to Leitmeritz, which is close to Theresienstadt. And there he handed me over to a Czech police officer with a jeep. He gave him money for taking me and gave me some Czech crowns. And when I wanted to turn around and thank him, it was just like he had vanished in the crowd. And then this lovely police officer drove me to my mother's camp, and we went through horrible destructions, the after effect of war. Do you need to stop for a minute?
No. Anyway, of course, your mother was there, your mother was there, and actually, she had, at least, she was in fairly good health, wasn't she?
Well, yeah, fair. She had lost a lot of weight, and it was just marvelous when we saw each other again. It was June 7th, 1945, and we had been separated for 18 months.
All right, you hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is, of course, Anita Dietman, her book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell. And so then, of course, was your mother able to leave the camp at that time?
Well, she then shared with me the horror stories of her camp and how the Russians just came in the nick of time. If they would have come 24 hours later, they would all have been gassed.
In other words, they were gassing people in your mother's camp.
Yes. In fact, the gas chambers were almost completed. And they were going to gas the remnant of the people that had, survived. But a man from Switzerland, a neutral nation from the Red Cross, came and he found out about the gas chambers and then left and went into a horrible battle between the Germans and the Russians outside the camp and asked Russian commander to hurry up and save the people, and they did just in the nick of time, 24 hours longer, and they would have been all dead. My mother had a chance that morning when I came to go back to my hometown, but she had refused. She said, if my daughter comes, she comes here, and she was right. And then about 3 weeks later, we were taken by military, American and British military vehicles. There were thousands of us to Deggendorf in Bavaria, to a refugee camp. We achieved contact with my sister, but England couldn't take permanent residence, so then God blessed us with an organization in America, the ACCR, the American Christian Committee for Refugees, and we were then signing up, and so a few months later, on June 7th was an interesting date. Now, this was, of course, 1946. About 900 of us boarded the SS Marine Flasher, Orthodox Jews, other Jews, and a very handful of Messianic Jews like my mother and myself. And we started to sail. It was a journey of about 11 days, pretty rough, but it was awesome. And this is when I really get very emotional, and I want you to forgive me, but it was so awesome. They've been on June 18th, early in the morning. We could see the outline of the Statue of Liberty through a rather foggy sky. It was so beautiful. There was not a voice. There was not a dry eye. Everybody was up on deck. Everybody stood silent. Finally, after so many years of oppression, to suddenly be free. It was a dream that we've all had for 13 years.
Well, God bless you. It's a wonderful story, and I thank you so much for writing it, and I hope it will touch the lives of many, many, many people.
And thank you for inviting me, and thank you for giving me the time to tell it all.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Anita. Of course, we're going to be carrying a book. It's called Trapped in Hitler's Hell. It's very interesting. I was stationed at Deggendorf in Germany in 1952 when I first went in, 1953 when I first went into the military. So, I haven't heard anybody mention Deggendorf in such a long period of time. But Anita was actually taken there in a concentration camp, but it was just a sort of a staging camp. And then, of course, they were moved from Bavaria and had the opportunity to come to America. Well, if you'd like to hear the entire story, and of course, part of this is not on the tape that our listeners have heard, but you can get the entire story from us here at Radio Liberty if you'd like to get her book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell. Why it's a wonderful, wonderful book, a testimony of a woman who had to live totally on faith. And ladies and gentlemen, we're entering very difficult times here in America. We're going to war with Iran. You ask yourself why we're going to war with Iran? Well, because there is a much bigger plan, and unfortunately we're in for very real problems economically here in America. I believe we're going to lose most of what we possess physically, and I think we're all going to have to rely, as Anita did, on the Lord to protect us in the difficult times the very difficult times that lie ahead. So anyway, if you'd like to get her book or you'd like to hear the in full tape, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and understand that what happened in Germany is the people had turned against God. And they've turned against God here in America. In fact, God has been taken out of our classrooms. God has been taken out, certainly out of our courts. God has been, prayer has been taken out of our courts. They're trying to take the Christ out of Christmas. Understand there's a conspiracy against God, and it is exactly the same spiritual forces that were at work in Hitler's Germany in the 1930s that are at work here in America today. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. And of course, we would mention that we are still offering, at least through this week and maybe into the first of next week, the cases of Brotherhood of Darkness, which ordinarily sell for $12.95 each, and you can get a case with 64 books for $149.95 plus the shipping, a wonderful tool to reach people and let them understand what we are really up against. And, of course, Hitler's Germany was simply a manifestation of the occult influence in Germany. And that occult influence is right here in America today, working at the highest levels of our government, bringing us first into a war with Afghanistan and then to a war with Iraq and next into a war with Iran and Syria. And you are involved whether you want to be or not. There is no neutral ground. Men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. So we hope that many of you want to get our information. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We have three little pamphlets we put together called The Occult Hierarchy, and it goes into the occultic movement that energized Adolf Hitler's society and is energizing America today. And we simply take the articles from the occultists writing here in America about what they're up to and where they intend to take us. That's The Occult Hierarchy. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, we'll send it to you. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to see one of our latest talks. It's called The World Revolution, that explains the background of the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and the continuing revolution right up to this time. And, of course, you must understand that there are the occult forces working at the highest levels of our government today. Look at the emblem on the back of the dollar bill. Ask yourself, what is a pyramid capped by an all-seeing eye have to do with America? And it has nothing to do with America. It has to do with the secret societies that were here when America was formed and are in total control at the highest levels today. If you would like to get the video we have called The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, that's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. It would explain how this all fits together. The secret society that was here back in the 1640s and how that secret society is influencing what's going on in America today. Not one, but many secret societies. And then, please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.